July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Storytime with Book Signing with Tanya Lippert on Saturday, July 6th at 1 p.m. at Books Around the Corner in Gresham. Tanya Lippert is releasing the book Goodbye School, where the main character Franny is preparing to move to a new school and saying goodbye to the old school. Again, that's a Storytime and Book Signing with Tanya Lippert on Saturday, July 6th at 1 p.m. at Books Around the Corner, 40 Northwest 2nd Street in Gresham. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, good morning, Portland. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. My name is Jonathan Ogden. I'm filling in for the ineffable Paul Roland. I'm here with my guest Kaz Felix from the NRS Collective, and we're going to be revisiting the previous topic of different facets of capitalism and mental health and some of the programs that we may be seeing coming about in Portland specifically and what they might mean for different communities, specifically marginalized and vulnerable communities. Take it away, Kaz.
All right. Yeah, it's good to be back. I know last time we were talking about events that were going on with folks that are connected with Rethinking Psychiatry and Portland Hearing Voices. And I guess the connection there is just that they really emphasize using a peer support model and learning how to care for a mental health crisis in a way where you're not in a situation where you don't know what to do, you know, and where you think that your only option is to call 911, because a lot of the time that can really increase the danger for folks.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. I mean, what was it, something in 2017, those numbers, right? Over half the calls police received were mental health related, and then, like, a lot of times they're not trained, and there's a whole lot of blowback against that.
Right. There's just not really a system set up for first responders to specifically mental health crises, because, you know, cops are not trained to be social workers, but they are essentially being forced into the job of doing that. But sometimes that has really disastrous results. And, you know, we've seen that over and over, that people have been killed when they're having a crisis of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, we're familiar here, you know, RIP, there's quite a few people who've had that. I mean, TriMet Police, right, that whole thing was really a bad scene. I mean, that's kind of the nature of the cops, though, is that they're inherently violent enforcers. They come from that lineage of being slave patrol. They're not exactly well-suited to this, right? So I know that they had said something about there being a new program that I believe Street Roots exactly was working on with the city, where they're going to have first responders. But, I mean, as far as what the community actually needs, from my understanding, there's not really a peer-run program like Right to Survive had, where they had the stopover sleep site that was run by people who could see these signs of kind of psychosis or any drug-related issues. Like, they're more accustomed to it. They also knew what treatments were available. They had some medical staff on hand, from my understanding. Is that the kind of thing you think would actually be an equitable solution, or is Portland going down the wrong path right now, trying to incorporate cops again?
Well, I think it might be too early to say the direction that Portland is going to go in with that, because it depends on where the funding gets put. If it gets put into programs that are more like a crisis response, social work response, I think that would be great. But we've seen in the past that that was kind of the goal with having Project Respond go out to respond to mental health crisis. But now we know that, I mean, Project Respond always shows up with the police, so it's not necessarily a better situation.
Oh.
If someone is escalated by seeing police officers there, they're still going to be there with Project Respond. But I think, you know, this could be a good change in the right direction. As far as what already exists now for peer support. A lot of it is sort of ongoing support models, like groups that you can go to just for kind of day-to-day support, but it's not something that serves that need of crisis response. So that's the thing we don't really have services for right now.
I imagine that also kind of puts the burden on the individual, right? That reductive, capitalist, atomized, you better know how you feel and figure it out right now and get some meds for it, or else you're not going to be able to get a job, right? Like, we're going to kick you out in the street anyway.
Well, and I really like the sort of like talk model of peer support, where you go in a group and everyone just kind of takes turns talking, because it does some things well for people that are not in a crisis right at that moment. But it also kind of requires you to just be coherent enough to be tracking, like, what day is it? What time is it? I need to show up at this group. And then also be able to, like, keep track of people taking turns so you're not, like, talking over people. And so that requires you to just be in a state of mind where you're not in a crisis, because, you know, when you're just having a really hard time and maybe you haven't slept for like 4 days, you're not going to be able to go to a group like that.
So
I think it's really important that we do have some kind of service created that's a crisis response specifically.
Yeah, definitely. I know that in previous discussions, you know, stuff like hotlines have been thrown around that allow, you know, people to respond to immediate localized issues. But do you have any specific examples that we might be able to point to, that, you know, crisis lines and things like that? We do have a caller. We have Sean on the line. I don't know if we could take that caller, maybe bring that up in context of the question.
We can start taking calls now.
Yeah, why not? Looks like Sean dropped off.
We lost Sean.
We lost Sean.
You can call back if you still have a question.
Yeah, please do. The number actually, the KBOO number I'll have to get, but there's a call-in number, which I'll get in a moment.
Well, this is it, right?
Oh, yeah, it is.
Here we got it.
Air Room phone, 503-231-8187.
Yeah, 503-231-8187.
Thank you. Sorry
about
that.
You can call us back. We are, just going with the punches. I think Sean might be back on the line.
Yeah, I'll wait for the flag. But it's just visiting in for those joining us. This is KBOO Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with Cass Felix from the NARIS Collective. And we're talking about capitalism and mental health and different programs. Feel free to give us a call about it. So these peer support models, you actually mentioned time, and that's kind of something that's been really bothering me. I mean, struggling with
I'm always bothered by time,
Abolish just, time already, right?
Right. I had to be here, like, really early for me to be on this radio show, so I'm already upset.
Oh, we appreciate you, though.
I'm just kidding, but yeah.
Now, being here with people in the morning is important, but also recognize the time seems to be something that capitalism is relentless about, right? It's always, you got to be somewhere at some time, otherwise you're not going to live, right?
Yeah, really. Like, you can lose subsidized housing and things like that if you don't check your mail soon enough and go to all your appointments. Mm-hmm. That can be deadly.
So the whole setup of this kind of atomized, individually responsible mental health model really doesn't seem conducive to the actual effects and how you're feeling. I mean, just personally, I've had times where I'm not sure what's wrong, but I've woken up and literally the whole day went by really fast.
Yeah.
And it just didn't know what happened, but 8 hours were gone, you know?
Yeah, time can go by very differently. You know, even if you're not experiencing psychosis, which definitely changes your perceptions, but if you're dissociating from stress, that also completely changes your perception of time, because you might lose time if you dissociate for a while. Mm-hmm. Then you come back and start thinking about, like, what did I do for the last hour, and you might not know.
Okay, I believe Sean is not back with us, my bad.
Oh, okay. Well, keep trying. Yeah. You know, if you wanted to call us, keep trying, because we're here for you.
Absolutely. So continuing with that, that really then points to this issue of the expectations that we're holding for a lot of the houseless community. And we've discussed that at length on the show. Right. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something I'm pretty familiar with, just because I do work as a social worker with houseless folks currently, and people that are moving into, like, transitional housing programs. But I think people, especially people who are not disabled, don't realize, you know, if you are disabled, and homeless or just disabled and not homeless, and you're not working, you have so many appointments to keep up with that it is basically a full-time job. And it's not like a life that I would be able to keep up with personally, even though I do keep up with working 40 hours a week. In some ways, I think it's harder because if you're not able to drive, you have to rely on bus schedules and always be on time.
Okay, I think Sean is back on the line. Let's go ahead and go to Sean. Hey, you with us, Sean?
Can you guys hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Cool, cool. Hey, this year is the 30-year anniversary of the murder of Ignacio Martin Barro, the Jesuit priest in El Salvador who coined, I guess if he didn't coin the term, he popularized the whole concept of liberation psychology. Mm. And I guess that involves like de-ideologizing psychology, like addressing power conflicts in society and taking that into account, the context of that in therapy. So I guess the purpose of my call is to just talk about the peer support thing a little and like maybe call it into question a little bit, because there seems to be kind of a deprofessionalization of therapy. And I think, you know, the whole community-based model that's been grossly underfunded for years and years and years, is at risk of, you know, being deprofessionalized and like, it's like doing mental health on the cheap. Mm-hmm. Like, if we're going to grossly underfund these outpatient clinics, then I would actually argue that the inpatient model would actually be better than that if we properly funded them and had like class conscious liberation psychology methods being used with people who are, you know, facing mental health crisis on an unprecedented level in this decaying capitalist, you know, wasteland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Well, that.
So I guess I just want to throw that into the conversation and, you know, talk about, you know, the peer support thing can be kind of, for folks who've been in the system for a while, it can be a little off-putting because, like, on the one hand, yes, okay, it's someone that can relate to your situation, but on the other hand, it's a little bit like the blind leading the blind. I mean, I want someone who's been in school for 8 years and, you know, has a lot of training behind them. So I'll just stop there and let you guys go from there. Thanks.
Thanks, Sean.
Right on.
Yeah.
Appeal to the institution a little bit, though, right? That's kind
of the thing. Well, a little. But I think that he brings up some really valid points, especially that peer support is often brought up as a way to cut costs, because if someone doesn't have those college credentials, they don't have to be paid as much as someone who's gotten the degrees and everything. So as far as like having more folks that have a background in liberation psychology, I think that sounds fantastic. And, you know, if some people aren't comfortable with peer support and they would like someone who has a doctorate, then that's totally fine. I think people should be able to seek out the help that feels right to them. I don't know a huge amount about liberation psychology, but it would be great if that was something we could find, because I've been in a position where I'm trying to find a professional trained psychologist to help work on some, you know, cognitive behavioral things with me, but I can't connect with my therapist because they're coming from that really hierarchical model or wanting to just prescribe meds, which is not what I personally want, although it does help some people. So it does bring up some good points. I do think generally peer support folks should be paid more than they are, but that's a different issue.
How couldn't everyone?
Right.
Yeah, and so that just brings up the fact that there's a reductive capitalist element again, like cheapening the thing. But we do have Rika on the line, or Rika, I'm sorry. Are you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right. Nice to hear your voice. How are you this morning?
Doing good. Thanks for talking about this today. I just wanted to mention, you guys had mentioned Street Roots a little bit earlier,
mm-hmm.
and they came out with a really like helpful printout that you can download from their website that's called If Not 911, Then Who Responds? And it has alternatives to calling the police. Because like yesterday, I witnessed police responding to someone having a mental health like issue, and they had 8 grown men. Some of them, I think, were the police. Some of them were like fire. Some of them were the EMTs. And they were holding down a grown man, like pushing down on his head and his neck while he was screaming, you know, telling, like, let me go, and they kept injecting him with something while he was, like, screaming to everyone, please film this. It was really distressing to watch. And, yeah, and I just wondered, you know, who had called the police, and, like, did these people know that there's alternatives to, like, people who know how to handle this, because they were just sort of, like, smiling at him and kind of mocking him, not in a way like they were making fun of him, but it just didn't look like people knew how to address what he was going through, because they were just taking it so lightly, and they were all hovering around him, and he was clearly getting freaked out by all the people surrounding him. And it was just really, really distressing to just watch so many people just fully holding him down, and then they strapped him down to, like, you know, the bed and everything. And so, yeah, I just want to let people know that Street Roots does have something out there. If not 911, then who responds? So I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Totally.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I kind of want to lead off to see if you could elaborate on that, more over things we could do to not call the police. But just that mention of the character of the police and basically the lying that has just gone on, like the deceptiveness. There's this kind of weird... They're almost like magicians who are like, oh, no, everything's fine. We'll keep it fine. They want to maintain this appearance of calmness. And so that whole element.
Right. So smiling while you are also, you know, forcibly injecting someone with sedatives against their will. Like,
the happy face on it. It'll be all right.
That's not a good situation. And, you know, I think maybe if people haven't witnessed that, like Rika did, they might not know that things like involuntary restraint with folks is still something that happens a lot, and most of the time it does escalate people and make the situation worse.
Oh, I wonder why.
Right. Yeah, it's a little traumatizing to be restrained against your will, especially by this, you know, group of like armed people that I'm sure if someone you know, had any paranoid delusions at the time about like they're being followed or there's an agency that's keeping track of them, you're all of a sudden being tackled by these people in uniforms. That's not going to help with your situation.
Confirms all that paranoia. Now you're in super fear mode. I mean,
yeah. And it's that fear that's like, you know, fight or flight plus a huge adrenaline dump plus maybe you have extra strength because you're like in a psychotic episode, which is why sedatives don't always work, because people are in these different states of mind. But it is better if you can maybe try to calm people down. I mean, it's not always possible, but definitely like trying to push down on their head and neck and grabbing them is definitely not the way to go.
Yeah, that seems like a bad setup. We do have another caller. Can we get Karen on the line?
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
I'm going to turn the radio off because it's not coming through the phone. The show isn't. So I just wanted to reinforce what Sean was saying.
Yeah.
I wanted to just put some particulars into the picture. If you have someone who's a really big person and they're acting out on some kind of paranoid delusion that, you know, that the mafia is shooting at them or whatever, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They need to be contained. And that takes people with the knowledge and the skill, as well as the compassion and the kindness and the recognition that this issue is a human process, to do that. And I think it's the dehumanizing of mentally disordered people that is so destructive. It's that we don't think of mentally ill people, as having behaviors that are exaggerations of normal behaviors. And Harry Stack Sullivan wrote a book about mental illness as a human process. And I think if we can see it that way, it's a lot easier to be kind to one another.
Do you have the title of that book?
It might be Schizophrenia as a Human Process. It's been 40 years maybe since I even thought of it. So something like that, but Harry Stack Sullivan. And I think that that the lesson of a psychiatrist, his name was Oh, well, he wrote a book called The Dancing Healers, and his name is Hammerschlag. It's a very difficult name, H-A-M-M-E-R-S, think S-C-H-L-A-G. And he writes about how Native peoples, he was in the Four Corners area, he was conscientious objector during Vietnam War, so he was assigned to this psychiatric role there. And he would tell how, in this Dancing Healers, how the community would contain the issues. There was a man who had killed his brother, and they took him into the Native American Peyote Church, and which the psychiatrist was a member of, and they helped that man to heal that way, holding him in community and then using peyote. He talked about a woman who had a psychosis postpartum, and her own child had died, and she stole another woman's baby from the hospital. Now, in our culture, you know, you can see the tabloid headlines screaming. And instead, 3 days later, she brought the baby back, and the family invited her for Mother's Day. And she brought a kid, like a little goat, right? And as an offering to the family. And I thought,
so it's sort of a form of restoration in the community, it sounds like.
Yeah, and being held in the community, not being considered evil or not human or not part of the community, but the community would take responsibility for the person and help them to heal. So those are just some thoughts about, this is a really complex problem, but I believe that mental illness, in many ways, is just another illness. It's a something is off in the brain. I'm not saying that capitalism doesn't affect it in a very negative way,
and that the trauma as well in the environment,
in the systems, that those aren't very damaging. They are very damaging. They're very, very damaging to people. And but looking at it as if it just comes from capitalism, well, I don't think that's the case. I think that there's a diathesis, which is like the Achilles heel, and then there's a stressor, and this capitalism produces lots and lots of stressors, and maybe also viruses, or we just don't know.
Yeah, but that seems like that might be part of that whole chicken and the egg question. And we do think we have another caller. We got to get to Shannon, but
generation, you know, we probably should do more research into how other communities have done that, and indigenous communities have been doing it for a very long time. I mean, sometimes you cannot avoid having to restrain someone. You know, I think that's probably true. I mean, I have not been in that type of work where I'm the one doing the restraining, you know, so it's hard for me to really say if it's always going to be a last resort that you have to do, but I do have bias there, you know, full disclosure that I have had a psychotic episode where I was involuntarily restrained and injected with sedatives by, it took, I think it was 5 medical professionals to restrain me because I was trying to escape from the hospital. I thought I just needed to leave. And honestly, maybe it wouldn't have been the worst thing if they just let me walk out. I think that grabbing me and sedating me might have made it worse. But so that's my bias there.
No, totally. I'd like to come back to that point about human or not, because we discussed that before. But let's go to Shannon if they're still on the line.
Hello, my name is Shannon Henrich. Huh? And I'm a native Oregonian. I've taught 21 plus years in special education for pre-K through master students. And I've been educating all over the country, and I'm back in Portland because that's where I wanted to make my biggest bang for my buck. And I had a lot of family members who had, like my uncle had schizophrenia, lots of suicide, lots of mental health stuff. And so my whole life became like looking at it from a community-based system, and my mom worked at the county at the time, and she helped start Care Oregon. And so, like, my whole world of how I saw mental health, physical health, all those components together. I worked with the I Have a Dream Foundation and some of our teenagers, and just what I'm seeing right now in the classroom with our kids struggling with figuring out identity and mental health component. I mean, I had like 12 kids on suicide watch at almost all times because of the volatile stuff that's pretty much come in since Trump, before Trump got into office. Like, I know it's a huge complex issue, but I'm really appreciating everything that you guys are saying, because I've been able, I was saying the other day to my best friend, I said, I don't know if I necessarily want to do it, because I want to be able to get the most bang for my buck for my small business that I'm starting, where I'm basically a multi-sensory integrator. I help people through any type of transition from pre-birth to death.
Hmm.
That could be challenging or not challenging or just whatever. But what we really need, and maybe we have something started, but I've been wanting to go take the time. I have chronic pain, so I can't always do exactly what I want to do. But I've been wanting to talk to leaders saying, we need people going in with the police in these instances, because like when I go into the, I don't know a kid, he's in the office and I happen to be going by, and I can take a kid totally raging, putting holes in walls, totally whatever, and in 30 seconds I can like literally calm this kid down because I am reaching them where they are, and I'm not forcing my agenda on them, and I'm meeting them with kindness, compassion, empathy, and caring, and they're then able to self-regulate because I'm regulated. You know what I mean? And I think sometimes we have people that, I don't think they always don't mean well. I just don't think they have enough training or understanding. And they do dehumanize in order to like, for some people to get through it. And that's one of the major issues we're having. And we've had, you know, since the white man came to the Americas, is we're perpetuating ancestral things over and over and over again.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, I'll get my doctor's appointment. And I'm like, yes, this is what I've been saying.
Yeah,
nice.
Appreciate
know, like
it.
An educator, you know. So thank you so much for the conversation. And I think there's a lot of work to be done, but I do think there are grassroots things happening. And I can tell you as an educator that's seen what's coming for public school, that's going to be a total rehaul, thank God, of the industrial model that's just a racist, terrible system.
Nice.
It's gonna redo all of these things, and the main thing has always been community and community education. You know, even my boyfriend from Spain and Mexico, he's like, you know, his idea of disability was, he's like, well, what if we have a kid that has a disability? I said, isn't that great? I have 21 years experience, and I have my whole life having a disability myself, and my mother like helped start Care Oregon and works for the county, and she's got all that stuff there. And I'm like,
you'd
you
be well connected.
Exactly. And you'd know where the resources are. And we need those resources for everyone, not just for our family.
Right.
And that's where I'm having a difficulty, is my mostly white friends from growing up in Portland are so fearful. They're only taking care of their little immediate group.
Right.
As opposed to the community at whole. And so I told them, I said, you know, something really tragic happens, I'll bring the bus and pick you up, but you're going to be the last one. I'm picking up the homeless individuals that I'm really close to and starting focus groups with. I'm picking up everyone else, because you guys have literally been so just in the dark and refusing to even open your eyes to see that maybe you don't know the whole story.
Right on.
You're white, privileged, entitled, blue collar, you know, whatever, that was the way my family was raised. You know, I learned from a very young age that the mental health stuff on my dad's side of the family, with his mother committing suicide and him finding her, and multiple suicides and schizophrenia, all that, that was nothing compared to the toxicity of the white patriarchal man society of I'm in charge and you will adhere. And my mom finally, and she's a feminist for God's sake, but she's finally seen it. She's like, oh my God. I'm like, yeah.
Right.
Sometimes
that takes time.
It is a process, and we super appreciate it. We got to get to Brian, but if
you
could follow up on the page, actually, just an announcement to everybody. On the KBOO page, if you go there and comment, we definitely want to reach out and get in contact with people who know about DIY programs, because we organize outside of this also, and we definitely want to connect people to services if possible. We have friends in, you know, Right to Survive and Sisters of the Road and some orgs where they're working on that kind of stuff, and I absolutely want the info if you got it. All right. I believe we're going to Brian now. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, hi.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. It's a good show. Thanks for doing it. And like everyone else probably that's listening, I've been watching all the interactions that we've become aware of with the police and homeless and mentally ill people. And not only that, the interactions with, you know, the things that have been brought forward by Black Lives Matter, and then now we're seeing, like on the news this morning, we saw this Facebook thing with agents, the way that they were posting just absolutely despicable stuff.
Secret Facebook groups and all that, is that you're talking about?
Behavior that's just beyond the pale from law enforcement, and what I'd kind of like to hear, and this is, I'll take it off the air, just maybe in the future, maybe some talk about mental illness in the law enforcement. It just seems like there's a lot of it. This behavior seems like mentally ill to me.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I see that point.
We tend to look at it like here are the cops and they're sane, but they're mean, and here are the mentally ill people. But man, that's I think there needs to be some talk about mental illness. Maybe they're what did you used to call shell shock? I'm losing the term, but maybe they're suffering from the experiences they have to deal with on the street. I don't know, but their kind of behavior seems mentally ill. So maybe in the future, I'll talk about that.
Yeah, I think that's a great topic.
Yeah,
thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks for calling, Brian.
We've had some great calls.
Let's say that number real quick for everybody, just in case you do want to call. 503-231-8187.
Yeah, 503-231-8187. You know, I've heard this kind of conversation brought up about, well, so is it mentally ill? You know, is there some kind of cognitive or behavioral problem with people who are abusive? Because sometimes that is the case. But I also feel like sometimes it's a little risky to take that route in conversation where you're describing abusive power as mental illness, because it's not the same as, you know, you having some kind of distress because of trauma, you know, because you were, brought up in a situation where these mentally ill traits were triggered. So then you start experiencing schizophrenia, or you start experiencing bipolar disorder or PTSD. I don't think that's the same thing as how we see, people start to dehumanize and abuse others when they have that power. So I think it's worth talking about. But, I think it's important to recognize that people who are mentally ill are more often victims of violence than they are perpetrators of violence.
Absolutely. And that actually brought up something for me, because we've talked about it on other shows with Paul, and we definitely try to run this continuous topic of colonization and its effects on culture as a background kind of analysis here. And the lady who I believe had mentioned that she didn't necessarily think it was capitalism, but the next caller who had called in and talked about how, I believe they said they were a Native person and a teacher, and that experience of being Indigenous has put them at odds with a lot of the values of patriarchal white society.
Mm.
That is definitely part of it. Like, having an identity outside of the productive identity of capitalism will put you at odds with it, right?
So right.
It's that system doesn't care about you, that inherent nihilistic quality of it's not for you anyway, that would probably create a lot of those stressors anyway, right? So it's still a material effect. It's a mental illness and material definitions are tied together, as well as control of those definitions and who's mentally ill or not, or a person or not.
That's who gets to make those labels, who gets to decide who's mm-hmm. sick and who's not sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think it's worth talking about how power and hierarchy is poisonous a lot of the time, but I don't know if I would use the same words to say that it's like mental illness, but it does have this very poisonous effect on people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's kind of the thing too, is I don't even know if mental illness itself can be qualified as a single like definition of a thing. It seems to be an interactive process of stress and the environment. And
yeah, and you know, potentially genetic factors that get triggered by those environmental factors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's less predictable and more about context and process, and restoration seems like a good solution. But we do have Devin on the line. You want to go to Devin? Oh, real quick, everybody. This is KVU Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. My name is Jonathan. I'm here with Kaz Felix from the Inaris Collective. We are talking about capitalism and mental health and the various effects that has on culture. And we can go to Devin now, if they're still with us.
Oh, hi. Sorry. Morning. So, calling from Hood River here. And I was wondering if any of these mental health resources that you guys are kind of discussing are available for folks in the Gorge, in the Greater Gorge area. And I was also wondering, that being said, if they have Spanish-speaking either resources within them, or if that's a separate kind of resource that would be available to folks out here, being that a lot of folks are Spanish-speaking and that's their first language.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just wondering if you could kind of speak to, like, if any of that is available for folks kind of in the Greater Gorge area.
Oof, I'll defer to Kaz. I'm not sure about that at all.
Well, yeah, it is a lot tougher trying to find resources out in those rural areas. I know as far as support groups, if you look up Portland Hearing Voices online, I think it's portlandhearingvoices.net, but they have a page of like current groups, current events, and they are not only located in Portland. They do have Hearing Voices groups that are in multiple areas. I think there might be a group going on right now in St. Helens that might not help folks that are out in the Gorge, but there are a few different locations there. You know, I think we're not really prepared in a lot of ways for having, you know, really necessary mental health services in rural areas, and also having that, the language component of people who are able to speak Spanish with people. So, you know, I mean, I will keep digging into that, but as far as I know, there just is a lot more organizing and probably funding as well that could be sent out there that's not currently there.
Yeah, it's a logistics thing, I imagine, a lot of time, right? So there's not really people who are going out there consistently already. Actually, that kind of speaks to the endemic of that feedback, especially for first language, or if you're ESL, you know, it's English as a second language, or if you only speak Spanish as an immigrant. I know that both are dealing with a lot of that in the day labor immigration types of scenarios. You're even less served by these accessible
right.
things, right? They're not designed for you.
Right, yeah, and services that are, you know, getting some funding right now from Multnomah County probably are better equipped to have social workers who are, you know, bilingual or multilingual and speak Spanish. But I guess you see a lot with professionals that have those credentials. They don't really get the funding to pay for those people that have those higher credentials
mm-hmm.
going out to rural communities. So a lot of the time there is like a bigger need out there.
I feel like that is the greater point to examine, especially with respect to somebody who doesn't believe that it's part of the capitalist process, because that selection process is based off the profit motive. And so if you're not profitable, you are not going to get services, you are not going to be accommodated, and thereby that creates that disparity, right? That would require the assumption that you think that the system will work for those people. And it will not, ever. It was based upon the structure of, you know, saying these are the people who will do the labor because they're too ignorant to feel. You know, phrenology back in colonization really was all about the aesthetic examination of mental capacity, and a lot of assumptions about that kind of continue on still. A lot of the racist stereotypes are drawn from that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to see more outreach, like organizing out to those areas that need it. Because, I mean, so far what I've seen is that people who are trying to do more peer support models, I mean, a lot of the time folks like that are living in a city because that's where you can get trained, you know, to receive, like, your peer support credentials. And, like, if you don't have a car, you know, where if you have a disability, you might not be able to afford a car, then it's easier to live in a city that has good public transportation. So you don't really see people like trying to go out to those rural communities because a lot of the time they can't. If it's just this little peer support program, we might not have the resources to send people out to Hood River, even though it would be really, really great. if you know, there was some kind of program to just go to these areas and then train people up who live in those communities, mm-hmm. you know, then they wouldn't have to be trying to like import professionals from Portland and Seattle. They could be like training their own peer support models there. So I would love to see stuff like that happening.
I think that is a super good track to go down, considering a lot of the other things we've discussed about how networks function and generally how you can communicate or whether or not you should have to signal to receive resources, right? So to your point, it sounds like an outreach model where there's actually people who are cogent and trained and are going out and not necessarily patrolling. These aren't police, but they're a part of the community. There's basically a network of people who keep track of areas that they know are going to be high risk or something, right? Like, that seems like a productive model.
Right. Yeah, yeah, and hearing voices trainings do kind of travel around and go to different areas, but that's only, like, one form of support, and it's it doesn't cover everyone. It doesn't, like, ensure that we have folks getting trained who are able to speak Spanish, and those would be great things for us to think about more, I think.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you consider how much institutional violence exists in the current system. Like, a lot of people don't want to go to shelters for reasons like that, from my understanding. And there's actually a really good paper from Kimberly Crenshaw called Mapping the Margins that talks about reducing violence in those spaces by saying you got to group people by their common identity and what they believe in and allow that to self-form. We do have another caller. We have Todd on the line. I don't know if they're still on the line.
Hi there, yes.
Hey, good morning, Todd.
Good morning. Yeah, for the caller from Hood River, a friend of mine works at La Clinica in Hood River, and I know they have some medical and behavioral health services there, so that would be a bilingual, actually Spanish specializing clinic.
Oh, great. And then,
yeah, and then I think also a good progressive behavioral health organization that serves all of Eastern Oregon. They have a member services line, and it's GOBHI. GOBHI is Greater Oregon Behavioral Health, Inc., and you can call their member services line, and then they will connect you to the whole network. There's a lot of peer services also in Eastern Oregon, lots of new peer support programs that are springing up. There is a lot of funding in Eastern Oregon. So
I'm glad to hear that.
People do just need to dig around, like you were saying. You're going to do more of digging around to find out what's out there. There's a conference that's the Eastern Oregon Behavioral, or the Eastern Oregon Peer Conference, August 5th to the 9th in Boardman. And so you can go to Eventbrite and see about a very progressive peer support conference that's happening in Boardman that is designed to connect people all over Eastern Oregon. And so Eventbrite, and then put in Eastern Oregon Peer Conference, and that'll really connect people right there.
Awesome. What a great resource.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tom. That's awesome.
All right, you guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you for the show.
Yeah, appreciate it. All right, I believe we have Tom on the line.
Yeah, this is Tom with Healthcare for All Oregon, and I'm glad to hear that there's something going on in the present with this conference and the peer-to-peer support. But we just passed in Oregon SB 770, to build a Healthcare for All Oregon plan, and a plan to take the profit out of healthcare in this state.
Nice.
And with a particular focus on mental health care, and getting out to the public to hear what kind of services they're going to want. But basically, we're going to build a one-payer system, and that just passed the Oregon legislature. It was the last bill passed on Sunday in the legislative session. And so we want people to, we're going to be reaching out and listening to people and say, what are we going to do to fix this system so people can get the care they need when they need it? It including things like making sure that the profit is not a part of it, because you're so right on, particularly in the areas of mental health care. If you're, and that means if we can move the profit out of it, we can move those dollars into training people to provide services. You know, we can have community health workers. Another thing in the short run we can do is I worked rural health. I'm a family nurse practitioner. I worked for a tribe. I worked in rural East Tennessee. And during that time, I've always provided services via like a telephone or, you know, like you can do like video services. And if you have a local peer support person, you can bring, if you can't put the professional, in quotes, professional services, let's say the degreed person out there, the degreed person can be brought in via a video conference while the peer support person is maybe present with the person. So there are systems we can build if we work on it to get the care we need. It's a really important topic that you're bringing up. And so I want people to keep an eye on SB 770. And if people want to follow what we're doing, it's Healthcare for All Oregon.
Nice.
At hcao.org.
hcao.org. Thank you so much, Todd. We appreciate you, Tom.
Yeah, right, cool. No, that's good information. Thank you. And okay. Also good to hear those models exist for, you know, connecting people over long distances. We can always kind of innovate a little bit more.
No, that brings us...
go ahead. Yeah, they do that in the... I'm learning more about it, but in one of the Dakotas, they have a very, you know, focus on making sure that the services, by whatever means necessary, are delivered out to the rural areas, right? And not necessarily depend on, you know, traveling for all those miles and all that stuff, you know, and all that travel is harsh on the environment anyway. So
true.
Totally.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for talking with us, man. All power to the people. It was good to hear you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just to recap, this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio on KBOO 90.7. I'm Jonathan, filling in for the ineffable Paul Roland, who's currently still in Italia, I believe. Shout out to Nautilus Press, translating Situation International stuff since when? Way back.
Long time.
Yeah. I'm here with Kaz Felix of the Inaris Collective. We are continuing the topic of capitalism and mental health and the effects therein. And we do have another caller. Is Edie on the line?
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can.
I didn't hear what you had been saying before I got into the car, and then I pulled over the side of the road and couldn't hear what was saying when I'm waiting on the phone. But I was thinking that there are brain tumors or tumors in the brain or the stuff around the brain tissues that are predominantly in women where they have scar tissue, which to me is associated with domestic violence, which is associated with PTSD, which is why the doctors they dismiss, oh, you're just a woman, you're just crazy, or whatever it is. And they're not aware of these different issues that are the doctor's approach to people who are suffering and society's approach to victims of violence is crazy-making, anxiety-provoking. Mm. And on the other hand, that there are actual physical changes in from the PTSD, and on the other hand, there are actual physical changes in the brain that are not well researched because it's just women and just crazy people. People don't pay attention to them. When actually, these are just symptoms of injuries that had they happened more frequently to privileged white men, they may have done more research and done more care.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of support groups there are for people who are, oh my God, I have a brain cancer. It's affecting how my body tells me about the world and how I can communicate and how I feel. And I'm not crazy. It's just the way people treat me is crazy making, and how my body is acting is hard. So I'm wondering, in that overlap where we wrongly label people and then limit what kind of resources and moral support and empathy and compassion we give each other, what is out there available?
Oh, we might have lost that call, but we did get most of Edie's message there, I think.
Yeah, what services are available that specifically deal with the stress of having other health-related things affect your mental health? I think that kind of speaks to the fact that mental health is more of a continuous, and it's not like a specific, oh, I got a cough and blah, 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 you know?
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, that the analogy of like physical illness is not always a perfect analogy. Mm-hmm. Because it's just so complex, because you could be dealing with, like Edie was saying, you might have, you know, some emotional fallout from PTSD, but maybe you also have a traumatic brain injury from domestic violence. And those definitely, like, work differently. I mean, they cause different things to happen in your behavior, but we might not be treating either one of those things properly. Really, I would say that like both PTSD and physical injuries from domestic violence tend to not be treated that well unless these are things that, while it certainly gets more press if you've suffered that as a result of serving in the military, but let's be honest, like veterans are not treated properly once they return to the United States.
And they know it. That's something, they're sold on something that then is like, you're completely left out to dry. You know, that VA is useless from what I understand. But that in and of itself, that's really insignificant to me because that talks about the state process of basically conscripting people and forcing you through these traumatic events and ignoring the effects of that because there's this acceptance that it's always supposed to be on the individual to be able to make it. If you're not strong enough, you're simply not meant to make it, which is, again, that root of colonial process of discerning who's worth it or not. Who is the person who receives the care and these things and, you know, why? But
right. And it's not very many people in the end.
Yeah.
You know, because even if you're like a white male cisgender person who goes in the army because you know, you're poor and you need the money from the military, you still don't get the services you need when you return.
Yeah, because it only serves the people who have the money, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and then it's also quite a bit worse just in terms of trauma that's generational that impacts people of color and especially indigenous communities that are still dealing with so much from colonization.
Mass incarceration going on too, like right. The mass integration.
And just how it affects us too if we don't have access to like nutritious food, which, you know, most reservations in the U.S. are food deserts. And people have been systematically cut off from their indigenous foods in a lot of places.
And the folk ways to produce them.
Right. So there's more impacts on top of impacts.
And real quick, again, this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I'm here with Cass Felix of the Anaris Collective. We're talking about capitalism and mental health. And I kind of like the roots of contextualizing it as a, I know Adrienne Marie Brown talks about things like hoarding and this excess hoarding of wealth being features of things that are unrecognized mental illnesses because of that power of definition, because of white patriarchy, those are positive qualities, you know, all these actually, it's like,
right. Yeah. So yeah, when did it, well, I guess it becomes a good thing to hoard as long as you're not poor, you know, because if you're a hoarder and you just have a lot of boxes of things in your house, that's a problem. But if you're a hoarder and you just stash millions of dollars in multiple bank accounts, that's not considered hoarding.
In multiple mansions.
Right.
And
yeah,
all this,
how many cars do you need? Things like that.
12 car garages. Oh, goodness. So that also brings up something to me that's really significant and important because of the larger ethical framework around our entire court system being based on this idea of penance, like all the way back to Bentham, right, in England, where you could reform people through making them think about it, how bad they did this in their own mind, blah, blah, blah. But really, that was an era where no longer was destroying the body a productive thing to do, where feudal societies were all about tearing people to pieces. You were pretty much expendable, public, you know, it was much more about the capital punishment being very visual. So now is the shift into the mental punishment because they wanted to save the body for productive work. Capitalism started to really take hold in Germany. It was getting hold in England and it was starting to crank out. So you had the shift once we went over and you know, basically colonized the New World. There was this Protestant ethic behind it that required that you didn't destroy your body because it needed to do work for God, right? So that created this idea of the penitentiary. And so the East Penitentiary.
I actually never even thought about how the word penitentiary contains the
penance.
Root of penance. That's
yeah.
Wild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's especially wild because I went to Philadelphia recently. I know our friend just went to Philly. The Eastern State Penitentiary. That one was the first real prison built in the United States, to my understanding. But it also is the thing that contains the Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So we're talking the Panopticon, which is based off of like Foucault writing about prisons, or is this just a physical design where you can observe someone from from all places at once.
Both, right? That's what kind of inspired his idea of, well, they just took this idea of penance and applied it everywhere. Now you're always being watched. You're forever the watched, and you're forever the observed. And in this colonial model of extending the city state as the idea of the chosen people and the chosen city, and then the other is out here, it's maintained in this model of the analysand and the person who is the psychiatrist. So you can kind of see this patriarchal integration of mental health as a standard for how productive you are.
Right. Well, and you know, I mean, people often run into huge obstacles if they're too disabled to work. It's like, well, you know, what do you do if you're too disabled to keep up with a 40-hour a week job?
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to be approved for Social Security, you know, and to prove that you're disabled enough. Almost everyone gets denied with their first application just as a matter of course. That's usually what the mm-hmm. Social Security Administration will do, because it roots out people and causes them to give up trying to seek Social Security. So you have lots of folks that are disabled that are not getting support. And well, then what happens? Then I guess you're going to be on the street mm-hmm. because you don't make enough money to pay for your housing.
This is the rich people's plan, too. I mean, if you look around, what they're doing is militarizing and reinforcing their enclaves at the moment, right? And so all the people who are left out to dry, they're not going to do anything about it, as far as I could tell. There's no plan. And that is why, contextually speaking, capitalism is this root problem of dehumanization, because that is its root. It's integrated with the process of colonialization. It's integrated with the production of chattel slavery to create the value of the dollar, and nothing else would matter in that context of where the dollars will go. And so until we get away from that, I mean, it's absurd. The world's burning to death, and they say that we need to slow the economy down in order to stop that, but this absurd compulsion to hoard is driving everyone else. It's like Sadia Hartman talks a lot about that. The entire economic whim is based around the whim of the white man and the master situation. Right. So like,
right. And they do, like, in the city of Portland, we get these occasional little glimmers of hope as far as the housing crisis. Oh, we're going to build more affordable housing. You know, we're going to allow these buildings to have more units in them that are reserved for being affordable units. But mm-hmm. I mean, because I'm in my job trying to get people who are in transitional housing moved out into permanent housing, and it is very difficult and very competitive. There was a new building opened up recently called the Woody Guthrie. Mm-hmm. There's about 60 units in that building for affordable housing, and they received 600 applications.
Jeez. And that's the other thing, too. We've talked about it on other shows, the definitions of affordable, and you continue to say allow. I think that's significant
right.
to me.
Yeah, because there are still, you know, there's buildings that are market rate where they just allow you to have a few units in that market rate building mm-hmm. that are affordable.
And even then, they'll peg it as a percentage of market rate. So if the whole thing swings up, they're still making money. And that's the whole game right now, right? They've turned rents into stocks, and it's affecting everybody because you're being displaced, you're being stressed. I mean, everywhere in the United States, you can't afford anything there's nowhere to live if you're a single person on a minimum wage. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
And everyone's known this. It's not news, but it's just continually reiterated now, and it's in the public sphere. So there's a real question as to the economic mode of keeping everyone alive needing to shift, right?
Right. And how much harder is mental health when you don't know if you're going to be able to pay rent and keep your lights turned on and all those things?
Yeah. I mean, if we have people who are diabetic not taking their insulin, imagine the kind of shirking you do if it's like a problem no one else sees, because that's totally a stigma of like, oh, you don't look sick,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right, yeah. But people still die if they don't have access to insulin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this whole economic rationing thing, I guess, is the point. The fact that we're having to always continually ration. But we should probably be closing up.
Oh, yeah, we're real close to 9 a.m.
Oh, yeah, and this is KBOO Talk Radio. This has been Jonathan Ogden filling in for Paul Roland. Coming up at 9, we have The Politics of Living, Elevating Women's Voices and Opinions Around Political, Economic, and Cultural Issues. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. But don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or iTunes or Google Play or your favorite podcast streamer. All these programs are made possible by member support, so if you'd like to become a member, go to kbu.fm or use our mobile app and click on donate. Please donate. You can become a monthly subscriber. It's super easy. It's really great. You should do it. And I want to thank you very much, Kaz Felix from the NARS Collective, for discussing this.
Thank you. I think we had lots of really good ground covered today in this conversation.
That was fast moving, yeah. And we were talking about capitalism and mental health, and please go to the KBU page and fill out any comments if you'd like to talk to us or reach out. Thank you. We love you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. The Waterfront Blues Festival is the largest blues festival west of the Mississippi. The festival features more than 100 performances on 4 stages, including the Robert Cray Band, St. Paul and the Broken Bones, Trombone Shorty, and Vintage Trouble. There will also be workshops, cruises on the Willamette River, activities for kids, after-hour jams, fireworks, and more. Again, that's the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Storytime with Book Signing with Tanya Lippert on Saturday, July 6th at 1 p.m. at Books Around the Corner in Gresham. Tanya Lippert is releasing the book Goodbye School, where the main character Franny is preparing to move to a new school and saying goodbye to the old school. Again, that's a Storytime and Book Signing with Tanya Lippert on Saturday, July 6th at 1 p.m. at Books Around the Corner, 40 Northwest 2nd Street in Gresham. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBU member listeners and support from the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government, offering a new master's degree in nonprofit leadership for those who believe in the power of collective action for social change. More information online at pdx.edu/Hatfield School. It's 9:01 on KBOO Portland. It's time for The Politics of Living.